Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, June 26th. Yesterday, June 25th, was exactly 1 month since the police killing, what Minnesota prosecutors call the murder, of George Floyd. What has changed and what still can? With us now is Rashad Robinson, president of the Racial Justice Group, Color of Change. Rashad, always great to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Can I start with that big picture question? 1 month later, significant protests every single day since. What, if anything, can you say has changed?
Well, we're seeing changes around the country as proposals around reduction of police budgets are going to the table. Magically, money that cities felt like they couldn't cut just a month ago are now suddenly they're putting things on the table. And we recognize that most of what's being put on the table right now is simply not enough. But the fact of the matter is the conversation has changed from more police and bigger police budgets to reducing police budgets and investing money into the things that we know actually keep communities safe. We're watching a reckoning inside of corporate America as Black folks and allies and people of color are speaking out and pushing back against policies that previously seemed like things we couldn't move. We're seeing a growing movement, Stop Hate for Profit, really challenging all the ways in which Facebook and their algorithms and their incentive structures have created a platform, the sort of largest privately owned public square the world has ever seen, that refuses to actually deal with hate on their platform. And we're seeing changes in Hollywood as an industry which has for far too long normalized injustice through the content that they put out while simultaneously standing on award stages and railing against Trump and Trumpism, having to come to a reckoning around the content that they've put out, which in so many ways has fueled the environment that we're in. I think so much has happened and is an absolute result of a growing and powerful movement of everyday people who have come to the streets and cities around the country, have taken action, as well as allies who are now showing up to the party and believe that there's a role for them to play as well.
We'll follow up on a number of things that you just listed. Let me start with Facebook, because I see that you met with Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg recently after Twitter had flagged the post by President Trump that said, when the looting begins, the shooting begins. Twitter flagged it as glorifying violence. And you made this very stinging comment about Zuckerberg after your meeting. Quote, the problem with my ongoing conversations with Mark is that I feel like I spent a lot of time and my colleagues spent a lot of time explaining to him why these things are a problem. And I think he just very much lacks the ability to understand it, unquote. So do you really think he lacks the ability to understand or just disagrees what the role of a platform should be, or it's somehow just all about money?
You know, that was probably the kindest way that I could put it. Ooh. You know, on one hand, maybe he either doesn't get it, or on the other hand, that he looks at all the ways in which for the last 5 years our back and forth engagement with Facebook shows me that their platform has fueled hate and violence, not just in this country, but around the world. So either he just doesn't get it or he doesn't care. And so I almost am trying to be more kind by saying that he doesn't get it. The fact of the matter is Facebook has 2.3 billion or 2.6 billion followers. That's more followers than Christianity. It's a private person who owns a public, who owns this sort of quote unquote public square, right? And I go into meetings with Mark where he will lecture me and other civil rights leaders about free expression, right? This billionaire trying to explain to folks who are fighting for justice what the kind of goals of free expression. And at the heart of it, not taking any accountability or responsibility for the role that his platform is actually playing and putting his hands on the scale. We will get things like new policies around violent content, hateful content, and then we will watch as Donald Trump will violate the four corners of those policies, only to have Mark Zuckerberg sort of look at us with a blank stare and not be able to explain why he can't take that content down. And then when we ask him, like, well, then what type of content would he take down? He can't answer that question again. So part of the stop Stop Hate for Profit campaign, which, you know, we are joined by folks like the NAACP and Free Press and the ADL and others, all who have sort of very different experiences that all lead to the same denominator of having a platform that is far too powerful and does not believe in sort of all the ways in which they should be responsible for what ends up on their platform. This has been a long time coming. A couple of years ago, folks may remember that the New York Times revealed that even while we were at the table trying to push Facebook to do better, Facebook hired a PR firm called Definers to actually attack my organization and attack me, to place and put in place stories in conservative and right-wing outlets about our organization. Instead of actually dealing with our demands, they hired some of the most subversive sort of elements on the right to go after us. This is a platform that actually counts the Daily Caller as a fact-checking media site and Breitbart as a trusted media site. Both platforms which have published addresses of black activists, which have elevated the content and the narratives from white supremacists and white narratives. And I've sat across the table at Mark while he's tried to explain to me why the Daily Caller can be a fact-checking site and why that is a sort of an acceptable cause. What we know at the end of the day, and what's become more and more clear, is that Facebook cares about growth and cares about profit. And our government has to do the work to hold these type of platforms accountable the same way that there's rules for media and there's rules for other corporations. But until that happens, we need corporations who provide about $70 billion in advertising dollars to Facebook to actually think long and hard. Do they want their corporate brands sitting next to content from the Boogaloo Boys or for other white nationalists? Because that's actually what's happening right now. What's happening right now is that while corporations can dictate to your program to a program that do commercials, TV stations, they can say, we don't want our content next to this. We don't want our content by this. When it comes to Facebook, they have sort of no intel on that. And content and hateful content by the billions of pieces are showing up yearly on this platform. And corporations have no sort of accountability and people have no recourse. And so part of this is about protecting our elections. Part of this is about protecting our communities against hate. And folks can sort of go to colorofchange.org or, Stop Hate for Profit, which are the campaigns that sort of we're part of that are hoping to push for some real change, which is so urgent as we march towards November.
Some who are skeptical that less policing rather than better policing should be the goal point to the rise in shootings and other violent crime in the last month, not to say the protests themselves are violent in, I think, most of these people's view, but that civilian crime is still a problem. And the police need to be in there at current levels, doing it the right way. How do you respond?
So, yeah, I mean, I love the magical world where all of the police are out there solving violent crime, and that's what they're doing all day. But the police actually have a very bad record of solving violent crime and actually even stopping violent crime. Most police are actually like, that's not what they're doing day to day. And the fact of the matter is, if that was the case, we'd probably see very different sort of results. Where we have a lot of police, we don't actually end up with a lot of safety in this country. Where we have parks and schools and mental health facilities and investments in all sorts of other things that we know keep us safe, that is where safety ends up being a thing that we can sort of rely on. And so I would say to the people who are worried about the rise of violent crime, the rise of guns, we actually need to figure out how to get more guns off our streets and how to have real, sensible, strong gun laws in this country. But I like the analogy around guns because I think it's important, right? More impotent gun laws don't actually get us a reduction in gun violence. Actually reducing the number of guns helps us reduce the amount of gun violence. And the fact of the matter is more impotent laws on actually how to deal with police, like chokeholds, when we know that if someone is trying to control you, if someone's goal is to hurt you, that if you ban chokeholds, that they're gonna find another way to choke you, or they're going to use the sort of powerful authority of a fraternal order of police that at every single turn has fought every single type of reform measure, every single type of change, and has supported time and time killer cops getting off. They're going to use those levers of power to avoid the type of accountability. And so I would love a magical world where we could, where we had a silver bullet, a quick silver bullet to fixing the deep and challenging violence that Black people face. But as someone who's been in this work for a while, who has gone back and forth to the Obama White House, who has met in rooms with police chiefs, who have sat at the table and tried to work on reforms, the idea that we can just put a couple of laws in place to fix a system rooted and built on control, not on public safety, is magical thinking. And it's the type of magical thinking that will get us right back here 3 years from now, talking about all the ways in which police are continuing to advance violence without accountability, control people in their communities, and make us, in so many ways, not more safe as a result.
You know, U.S. Attorney General William Barr was a guest on Morning Edition today, and he denied that policing is systemically racist in the United States. And he made this comparison between civilian killings and police killings, and also one between police killings or pertaining to police killings over time. Listen.
There are 8,000 Blacks who are killed every year. 85% of them are killed by gunshots. Virtually all of those are Blacks on Blacks. The statistics on police shootings of unarmed individuals are not skewed toward the African American. There are many whites who are shot unarmed by police. Now, those numbers, as I said, have been going down. In the past five years ago, it was 38 African Americans who were unarmed were shot by police, 38 in the year. This past year, 10. Of those, 6 were physically attacking the police when they were shot.
And the Washington Post has those same numbers. What's your response to the Attorney General, though, about whether that indicates a low and declining level of systemic racism in policing, and that police mostly protect people of color, mostly the opposite of what the movement is emphasizing?
Well, you know, I mean, the uprisings that are happening on the streets right now are not related to, you know, related to George Floyd, have nothing to do with someone getting shot. They have something to do with a knee booting being put on the neck of someone while the police officer had his hands in his pockets and his glasses on his forehead and looked directly in the camera. Eric Garner, the police officer didn't shoot Eric Garner, like they chokehold him. And so, you know, the fact of the matter is that we have a attorney general that doesn't think systemic racism exists, period, that has sort of dismantled the power and the infrastructure of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. You know, the latest Monmouth poll says about 70%+ of Americans believe that Black people face systemic racism, yet the Attorney General of this country doesn't believe that we face systemic racism and doesn't believe policing, which was actually built out of slave patrols in this country, doesn't have systemic racism in its DNA. That we have a country where we've actually had to just fight to diversify police forces, where Pat Lynch, the head of the Fraternal Order of Police, could get in front of a mic and talk about how police officers are being treated like animals. And you look at the Fraternal Order of Police members that were standing behind them, basically all white, inside of a city where the police force is almost half people of color. And you think about sort of how does that track back to whose voices are being heard and whose voices are not being heard. You know, I go back to the story that I wrote about in a recent New York Times op-ed piece about the sort of kind of challenges progressive district attorneys are facing around the country as they work to deal with the fact that we have a country that has 4% of the world's population and 25% of the world's incarcerated population. So that right there speaks to a whole set of ways in which we are sort of building an incentive structure around incarceration that does not work. And then on top of that, when you overlay the numbers of sort of like how different communities are attacked, it's not that Black communities are vulnerable, it's that Black communities have been targeted, attacked. No one can tell me that there's not just as much drugs being done on Columbia University's campus as there is in Central Harlem, and they are a stone's throw away from each other. But we know sort of how the system operates in terms of who is targeted, who is arrested, who ends up inside of the system. And so the quick story I will say is that, right, Kim Fox, the first Black district attorney in Cook County, who went into the office on a reform agenda, started to stop prosecuting low-level crimes, right? Things like driving with a suspended license, as long as you weren't sort of driving under the influence. Certain types of petty theft.
And that's Chicago. You say Cook County. That's Chicago, right? Chicago
for people. Cook County, Chicago. She stopped prosecuting these things. And this is a story that it's analogous to so many things that are happening around the country. But I'm explaining this now because the Attorney General says that there's not systemic racism inside of policing. And so Cook County, Kim Fox comes into office and she starts doing these things. We're seeing a reduction in crime in there. We're seeing a reduction in the size of jails, in jail entry, which is helpful to taxpayers. You're seeing all sorts of things. You're also seeing a reduction now in police hours, because police hours have to go down if you're not, you know, spending all your time going after people for petty crimes, because police are not out solving a lot of murders. They're out attacking people for being poor or petty crimes. And, you know, what ended up happening in Cook County was the Fraternal Order of Police marched on Kim Fox's office, their constitutional right to march, right? But they marched on her office, and they marched with four white nationalist groups, according to the Chicago Sun-Times, including the well-known Proud Boys. They marched in front of her office. They took out the picture of the first Black woman district attorney in Cook County, and they rubbed the picture of Kim Fox on their crotches in front of press because they felt that powerful. White nationalist groups, Fraternal Order of Police together, rubbing the picture of the Black woman DA on their crotch. And then the next day, those police officers put on their uniforms, and they put on their badges, and they put on their guns, and they go back into our communities to protect and serve us. You look at what's happening in Wilmington, North Carolina, where police officers were on tape being caught talking about all the things they were going to do to Black people sort of as a result of the uprisings, how they were going to use sort of their power to harm us and put us in harm's way. We send people who cannot be trained out of their racism. We send them with a gun to deal with people who pass a bad check. We send them with a gun to deal with people who are homeless. We send them with a gun to deal with our kids. And that has to stop. Budgets are moral documents. And for Mayor de Blasio, your budget says what your morals and values are more than anything that you actually say. And if your morals and values are about investing in communities and unlocking the potential and hopes and dreams, then we will put money in those communities and actually unlock the hopes and dreams. Because when a kid on the Upper East Side is having a mental attack, we don't send someone with a gun to deal with them. And so why is it that everything that involves Black and brown people has to be about control and can't be about putting in the type of resources and infrastructure to actually unlock the potential of all of our communities? Policing is at its core systemically racist, and the Fraternal Order of Police and other divisions of the policing have done everything in their power to keep it that way. They should be recalled, and policing should be downsized because they have failed in their fundamental responsibility to keep us safe. Because they don't care about safety, they care about control, and that is why we actually have to reimagine safety and justice.
Well, I know a lot of police officers would disagree with that, but Leah in Charleston, West Virginia, calling in. You're on WNYC. Hello from New York, Leah.
Hello. Thank you. I wanted to say that, I'm white, and the conversation that has, the degree to which the conversation about race has just so quickly permeated the world that I live in is fascinating, and I'd say that is one of the primary changes that I've noticed is I don't think I've had a single conversation with anyone in the past month that didn't eventually involve the topic of racism. And it's not that I hung around with a lot of extremely bigoted, that I knew of, people mm-hmm. in the first place, but it was just something sort of, you know, in the background, like, yes, we all know that's bad. But now, not only so-called, you know, progressive people that I know, but just people from all walks of life and strata, it's there. It's in the air. It is being discussed, and people are so actively trying to find, you know, figure out more about what we just sort of took for granted as, yeah, bad, but not very informed about it at all. And West Virginia is a primarily rural, very place with a very small African-American population, mm-hmm. but it's amazing to me how it has come to the surface and people are really at least discussing it now.
Do you have an example of something other than police or in addition to police that has come up in one of those conversations that sticks with you?
Yeah, actually, in it's sort of in lockstep with, or as a result of the coronavirus, it's a huge, as all over the country, reexamination of who is in jail. And of course, that starts with the police, but also the laws in place and the discretion in judging. And because so many, there was such a large move to get people out of jail who were in pretrial detention, who just didn't deserve a death sentence, a potential death sentence on a pretrial detention. It has caused a real discussion and a reckoning of why are these people there in the first place? Why, you know, once the police are done with their interaction, what are the judges doing? Why are they holding them without bail? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So bail has been a big discussion too.
Leah, thank you so much. We really appreciate you calling us from Charleston. Let's take one more, and then Rashad, you can comment on the set. Arthur in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Arthur. Thanks for calling today.
Hey, good morning to you all. It's good. Thank you for taking my call. All I wanted to say was, if I hear, I'm sorry, I'm 65 years old, I'm black, lived in the city all my life, have been a victim of police brutality, seen it. If I hear one more white gentleman, particularly from this administration, stand up and say that there is no systemic racism, I mean, nothing ticks me off more than anything else than to hear these men, who a cop would never assault, neither in them or their family, stand up and say there's no systemic racism. I'm talking about Barr. I'm talking about the one who's in charge of the, well, anyway, a bunch of them. I'm sick of it. If I think that what's happening right now is that there's a generation out there who have watched this go down through the years, every time there's one of these things happen, there's been a committee. And I think that there's people out there who are marching who are saying, we are sick and tired. Do not give us a committee and then after the election, take all the, you know, the findings and shard them in a shredder. We want something now, and we ain't stopping until we get it.
Arthur, thank you. Oh, go ahead. You want to finish that thought?
No, that's all I wanted to cut. I know the gentleman has other things to do, and you as well, and there are other people. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Keep calling us. Rashad, we do have about a minute left in the segment, so for anything you want to say on anyone in that set of callers and anything else you want to say going out the door.
The final thing I'll just say is that for the last 20 years in this country, violent crime has steadily went down. While police budgets have gone up, police have become more militarized. And at the same time, folks like Pew Research say that Americans actually believe that violent crime is going up. And so while violent crime is going up and we are spending more on policing and people think it's going up, none of that gap between perception and reality is not a mistake. It is fueled by a policing culture that wants to raise their budgets, fueled by the TV shows that come out of Hollywood, like the crime procedural shows, which is why Color of Change is working so hard through our Normalizing Injustice and Change Hollywood work to actually change the narrative and cultural conversation of these things. But at the end of the day, if we don't reduce and downsize and radically change policing in this country, we will not actually move towards safety and justice. If we want to reduce crime in this country, there are ways to do it. Adding more police is not one of them, because police have failed in their fundamental responsibility. Holding corporations accountable, holding institutions accountable, is part of this new work of civil rights. And I couldn't agree with Arthur Moore that the sort of generation of folks who are raising up, speaking out, and pushing back are going to demand nothing less than true systemic change, true systemic reform, and the type of changes that actually make all of our lives better.
Quick follow-up. Police will say, crime has been going down in this country for 30 years. So when you say police haven't done anything, they will say they've been a big part of the solution, not the only part, but a big part of the solution to the old 1980s, 1990s crime levels in this country. 30 seconds.
You know, that's, I mean, that kind of causation to correlation, that doesn't actually sort of pan itself out. Stronger economies where more people have access to work, you know, that those are the type of investments that have actually reduced sort of crime in this country, not putting more police on the streets. We actually saw the slowdown that police put in place in 2017, and we saw crime go down during that slowdown period in 2017. And so we know actually when we reduce the policing in our country that we can reduce crime. Increases and more spending on policing isn't what's actually reduced crime. It's real investment in communities that has.
Rashad Robinson, president of the Racial Justice Group, Color of Change. Always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much, Rashad.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Brian Lehrer, A Daily Politics Podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.